This is Amerinds.
Hi again, my name's Arthur, and I'm a gay American now living in New Zealand. Welcome to episode 71 of my Amerinds podcast for Wednesday, February 13th, 2008. Now, there is a reason why I'm recording on a Wednesday instead of a Tuesday, and the main reason is that it just wasn't working for me yesterday when I was trying to record an episode. It wasn't coming together right. And that has happened before, and I've ended up re-recording or starting over or something, but as it happens, I knew that today I was getting together with a fellow American expat who lives in Auckland, and I'd be recording. And so I decided I'd just post that today rather than waiting until Friday to post it. So I have other things I'm going to do on Friday, and I'll talk about that a little bit at the end of this episode. But right now, let's go on with that visit. Well, joining me now is Nick Durga, who is a fellow American expat living in Auckland, who's actually the first American expat I've actually sat down and talked with, who also lives in Auckland. Welcome, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, I have spoken to one other American expat since I've been in New Zealand. That was Don and Darren from Wellington. I've met Don since then. But as I was just saying, you are actually the first American I've spoken to who lives in Auckland.
There are more of us.
Yeah, I've gathered that, but I actually haven't run across them apart from the odd store clerk, but they don't seem to want to talk. Well, I have sort of ordinary questions that I ask expats when I talk to them. So I think I'll start with those if I can. And the first is probably the most obvious. When did you come to New Zealand?
Oh, it's just over a year now. It was October 23rd, 2006.
Oh, yeah. That's not long at all.
No, it's been gone by very fast.
So why did you come to New Zealand?
Family. It seems like the reason a lot of us come here tends to be you're dragged by somebody that you love. And my wife is a New Zealander, born and bred in Auckland, and has lived here most of her life. And she came to the U.S. to live with me almost 10 years ago now. And we lived together in the U.S. for about 8 years. And after we had a son and then been bouncing around the Western U.S. for a while, we thought, well, it's my turn to be the foreign one and the one who talks funny in the relationship. So,
the foreign ways.
Yes.
Well, when you had obviously traveled to New Zealand before you moved here to live, and I should actually mention that you do have a book of your columns called Spatula Forum, which is also the name of your blog, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a bit.
Yeah.
But so some of this stuff you've gone over in that book. Since you had been to New Zealand, you'd already probably had some impressions, which may or may not have been the same once you came to live here. So when you did come to live here, what were your first impressions when you came here to stay?
I think I was a bit stunned for a while, actually, because I was in a weird position where I quit my job, of course, to move here, and ended up not working again for about 8 or 9 months because we decided that I would be the stay-at-home dad, and my wife got a job almost instantly. And it was a decent paying job, so we thought rather than put our child in childcare, you know, he was dealing with a lot of transitions and he's only 3 years old, that I'd be a stay-at-home dad. So I was kind of, I think it took me a few months to process all of that because it wasn't just moving 6,000 miles away from everybody I knew and everything changed. I also lost my job, which defined you. So suddenly I had no definitions as to who I was anymore other than staying at home with a three-year-old, which was fantastic, but quite a change.
Yeah, dramatic change. And I don't know about New Zealanders so much, but we as Americans certainly weren't brought up that way for the dad to stay at home and look after the kids. We've sort of grew up with this expectation that if anybody's going to do it, it's going to be the mother.
Yeah, and that's actually what my wife had done for the first 2.5 years of his life, so it was kind of like turnabout's fair play, you know?
Fair enough, yep. But did you notice that your son had any issues adjusting to New Zealand after moving? Being quite young, I wouldn't have thought so, but
no, I think it's been pretty good because he's young enough to just get it. He's just turning 4 on Monday, so it was very good for him because he's got family here. We lived with the grandparents for almost a little over a year, and that was really good for him to be with his grandparents all the time because even in the U.S., we were at almost a day's drive from my family, so he didn't have grandparents around every single day. Mm. And that was very important for us, and one of the big reasons to move here is having his cousin and his aunt and everybody else right there. So he didn't have a huge... It was shocking, of course, because you're 2.5, and you know the world is your world, and he missed things a lot. But I think it was good for him in the long run.
Yeah, and kids are pretty resilient, so they tend to adapt pretty quickly, too. Well, did you have any big culture shocks or anything along those lines when you arrived?
Yeah, because I definitely made my impressions of New Zealand on several visits, you know, of 2 weeks to a month over the last 8 years. And it was a bit different, but I'd say I started to get a bigger picture of what New Zealand and Auckland is actually like, as opposed to just what it was like when I was staying at my in-law's house and getting out and meeting people outside of that family relationship a bit.
Well, did you end up missing anything from America, I'm thinking in particular?
Oh, quite a lot. I mean, besides the obvious, you know, family and friends. The culture is quite a bit different. American culture is everywhere, so you don't really miss it too much. And, you know, thank God for the internet, because it's entirely different than it would have been migrating here 10 years ago. You know, it's you're able to keep up with that. But the it seems a bit base to go to shopping, but the whole retail environment's quite a bit different. And even the big box stores here are very different than the American big box stores. And I can't believe it. And we were both aghast that we said this, but I actually missed Walmart when we first got here, because I liked the idea of knowing, okay, I'll go down to Walmart and get what I need. Whereas in New Zealand, it took me a while to get used to the different shopping environment and having to go to three different stores before finding white school glue. Yeah. That was one of the things that was a bit hard to get used to. And of course, the expense of certain things here that I've spent a lot of time with, like books and music and that sort of thing, took getting used to as well.
Although I noticed on my last trip back that because the Kiwi dollar's gotten stronger, the price difference, especially in things like books, isn't as great as it used to be.
Yeah, now that I'm working too, of course. When I wasn't working, I wasn't really familiar with what a New Zealand income would be. It was all just stunning. And it's psychological too, because New Zealand uses the dollar too. If it was the drachma or something, you wouldn't be making that comparison. But instead, it's dollars, and you see $50 for a paperback book, you know. Even though you know it's New Zealand dollars, it's still.
Yeah. So. Well, I found a lot of that as well when I first arrived, and I was in my head, I was constantly converting the price back and forth, because I thought, oh my God, that's expensive. Oh, actually, it's not too bad.
And now I just sort of shrug and, you know, I'll buy that now, but I won't, you know, go nuts. And
yeah. I think you do adapt over time.
Yeah.
Sort of get your internal measure of whether something's good value or not without having to do the conversions. Well, have you run across anything in New Zealand that you now can't imagine living without?
That's a good question, and I don't think of anything that I couldn't live without. I've moved around a lot in my life anyway, and I've never been the sort of person who spent, you know, his entire life in one town or one house, so I don't think there's anything I look at and think, oh, I couldn't live without that. But there's things that I would miss, you know. I like the New Zealand emphasis on a cup of tea and that kind of thing. The British influence in the culture is nice, because I always grew up admiring Britain and visited there when I was very small and thought, oh, it'd be fascinating to live in a place like that. So I like that we have the BBC over here, and the British newspapers are influenced a lot of the New Zealand coverage.
My mother was a big Anglophile, and I always thought that she would have just loved living here, because it was just English enough that she would have been happy with that, but American enough as well that I would have liked it. I'm talking as a kid now. But of course, it's all completely different now. It's sort of its own thing. As a matter of fact, there's a cover story. I haven't read it yet, but there's a cover story in the latest New Zealand Listener about British people thinking that New Zealand is not British enough anymore.
Yeah, I saw that. It was that Duncan Fallowell's book that's been raising a bit of controversy, that he came over here and is being seen as slagging off New Zealand in it. And yeah, it's interesting, because it's, you can't pinpoint New Zealand now. You could say it's British, and it's American, and it's Polynesian, and it's Asian. And Auckland in particular, of course, is nowhere like the rest of New Zealand.
Yeah.
You get outside of Auckland and you realize you haven't been in New Zealand quite yet.
Yeah, that's the truth. Especially the area where we live, there's quite a lot of Asians of various sorts. Around here in particular, it's more Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, and so on. In not very far from here, it's more Chinese or Korean.
Yeah, where we just moved to, we've got a, you know, it's a United Nations, really. You've got a lot of Polynesian and Maori, and a lot of Asian folks, and Indian, Pakistani, so it's...
Yeah, a little of everything.
Yeah, a little bit of everything, and one lonely American.
Well, it's probably more than you know them yet, or so I'm told. Well, what would you say is the best thing about New Zealand?
Well, I think it's a great place because it's especially now, and I think older New Zealanders may disagree, but I like that it's become this kind of global panoply of cultures from all over the world. And I particularly like events like Pacifica or some of the world fairs we've been to, where you just see that there are people from Africa that have settled here, people from America, people from England, and they all come here kind of looking for a better life. It's been like America used to be, and still is, of course, that it's seen as a place to aspire to by so many people around the world, and it's got its problems. That's one of the things I keep constantly telling my American friends, that no, I didn't move to some South Pacific island where I sit on a beach all day. I just do that once a week. But, you know, it's still a place that people look to and think, oh, I'd like to live there. It's not a place that, you know, you say Ohio and you don't have people think, oh, I've always wanted to live there.
My job, most people I know in Ohio want to get away. I'm just kidding. Well, what's the worst thing about New Zealand then?
I've been trying to focus this a bit in my head lately because I've been wondering about it myself, but it's an insecure country sometimes. Not all the times, and you can't say this about all the people. It's just like any, you know, sweeping generalization, but the cultural cringe isn't quite the right word for it, but you do see a lot of just a sense of what do other people think of New Zealand, which maybe they shouldn't worry about that so much. And things like the sport year was interesting to watch, when the All Blacks just collapsed at the World Cup, and the massive spasm of national grief over that. And everybody thought we were going to be great, and we weren't. And what does this mean about us as a nation? And it's, I don't think Americans are quite as worried about what their identity is anymore. Americans, a lot of them don't even probably think about what their identity is. But New Zealand is still very much trying to figure out what it is. Mm. And it's constantly changing. It's totally different than it was 50 years ago. So it's it's not a bad thing, really, but I think it's a country that sometimes just needs to not worry so much about what it is and just be.
Yeah. You especially notice it in international sporting events. I mean, I was talking about this just recently when I was talking about the study that found that New Zealand was seventh in the world in environmental quality or whatever it was. And that often comes up in the news where there's this fascination about New Zealand's ranking in the world about one thing or another. And sometimes I find it sort of endearing that they care that much about what people outside the world, outside the country, think about it. But there is a little grain of insecurity that goes with it that it would be nice if it could move beyond sometimes.
Yeah, and it's, you know, people think very well of New Zealand. I mean, in my limited little circle of friends and family, when we said we were moving to New Zealand, not a single person said, oh, why would you do that? You know, it was all, oh, are you going to meet any hobbits down there? You know, I mean, there was a lot of just fanciful idealization of what it would be like. But, you know, it is great. And I really like the weather and the scenery, of course. And I want to get out and see more of the country because I feel like we've been boxed in Auckland, really, for the last year or so as we've settled in. But
Well, has New Zealand started to feel like home yet?
A little bit. I found it, now that we've bought a house a couple of months ago and settled in there, it's definitely starting to feel a little more like home. But I don't know. I haven't felt like anywhere has been home since I moved out of the house at 18. You know, everywhere is a little transitory, and it's a bit weird for me now to feel like, all right, we've bought a house, we've settled down, probably going to be here for the next, you know, 10 years or however long. Mm. I don't like to place limits on where I'm going to be and how long we're going to be there.
But yeah. Well, since moving here, I've started to say never say never because you just don't know. Now, your wife, of course, is a dual national. Do you think that you might become a New Zealand citizen one day as well?
Oh, I think so. I never rule out moving to America. I don't think she's quite the same way, but it's very hard for us to forecast where we might be. You know, we wanted to raise our son here a bit and have him grow with his New Zealand family, but you know, he's going to grow up eventually and we'll still be relatively young, and who knows? You know, I certainly wouldn't rule out wanting to move back to America for a while, or heck, Australia would be fun to visit for a year or two, but. Yeah.
Well, you can easily do that as New Zealand citizens.
Yeah, first we have to win the lottery, of course, also.
Well, there is that, I suppose. Well, talking about this whole thing about moving to New Zealand and all that, is there one thing that you would like people to know about New Zealand?
Well, it sounds a bit awful to say, but that it isn't perfect. that there are issues and problems that need to be dealt with, and it's been an awful month or so for violence here, it seems like. That really stunned me, just the string of murders we had last month, that we're all very bloody and violent, and also pointless too. And I worry about the youth in New Zealand in particular, and it's definitely a sign of an increasing age that I'm thinking, oh, these kids, what's going to become of these kids? But I do worry sometimes about everybody under age 25 or so and how it's going to turn out for them, that you know, violence and sensation seems to become the primary goal in life. But obviously not everybody's like that. That's the headlines you see in the newspapers, yeah. And I well know that. So
what's interesting, too, that youth issues appear to be on the campaign agenda for the upcoming elections.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because I'm still relatively uninvested in New Zealand politics, and I really haven't dedicated myself one way or another, so I'm very swayable as to, you know, who has solutions? Are there solutions to the things that are going on? But I do feel that a lot of people in New Zealand feel like, oh, something's not working quite right. Something's a bit wrong with things, and can they be fixed? But it's a bit of a shame to see that some of the problems that are so commonplace in America have migrated over here. And I really am sad to see that so much of the Polynesian culture has taken what I consider to be some of the worst of American culture and run with it. You know, the sort of bling-bling gang mentality it's a shame that there's so many more uplifting aspects of America that haven't traveled over here quite as well.
Yes. I can't remember if I've talked about this on the podcast before or not, but a lot of the Polynesian youth sort of mimic African-American street gangs, particularly L.A. variety, but not exclusively. And they're not necessarily criminal just because they dress like that and listen to that music and so on, but it still creates the impression. And unfortunately, it becomes kind of a self-perpetuating culture almost once they start to go down that road. But I remember when I first came here, I was actually struck by that, about the Polynesian kids and the dressing in African-American clothes and using African-American street slang and things like that. And some of the kids, well, I just remember, I said this to Nigel at the time, I thought, you know, if any one of those kids went to Los Angeles and acted like that, they'd be shot, because they would not be accepted.
Yeah, there was an interesting article in the Star Times or somewhere about the kind of the gang culture in South Auckland, and how I guess some of them had tried to reach out to the Los Angeles gangs and say, hey, you know, you want to hook up, and they basically got laughed off the page.
Yeah.
New Zealand, what? Where's that?
Yeah. So well, you get that throughout America, actually. Well, one of the, well, you do a couple of things. One of them is a blog, which is specialaforum.blogspot.com. And there is a link on my blog, and I'll put one in the show notes as well. And you also have a book of the same name, which is available through lulu.com. I looked it up because I couldn't remember. And I actually did get a copy of the book. I have read it, although I don't remember all of it, because that's just me in a nutshell. I'm like that. But I do remember thinking as I was reading it, there were several things that that resonated with me, because I've been through not the same experiences, but similar enough that I was like, well, this is really quite relevant. And one of them in particular was, you were talking about your wife and son coming to New Zealand for a month. I think it was called Bachelor Party or something like that. But in that, you were talking about how it wasn't like it was, say, 100 years ago or wherever, where her leaving New Zealand would have been pretty much forever.
Oh, right.
And how you had the benefit of the internet and being able to send videos back and forth and all those kinds of things. I just think that that's really an important thing for people to keep in mind, personally, because if they do make a move to another country, it's not like it used to be. It's not a total cutoff, and it's not necessarily forever either.
No, it's not, and it's very hard for us to imagine our relationship working out the way it did, you know, 30 years ago. I don't even know if we would have ever met, really, because we connected in ways that you couldn't have done back then. But yeah, it helped when we were in the U.S. that her family were just an email away and you know, a phone call away, and it's the same way now for my family. It's certainly no substitute for actual face-to-face contact, and it's, you know, particularly tough with my family can't see their grandson, you know, grow up every day, but you try and make up for that by, they visited us last year and we're going to visit them this year. And, you know, you cut corners to pay the cost of the plane fares, and you know, you certainly aren't as isolated as you once would have been. I mean, it's
well, I got my sister set up on Skype with a video chat, so I highly recommend that, because I don't have to wait so long to see her now, in a sense. But about the book, what led you to do the electronic publishing route?
Well, it was kind of more of a keepsake for myself, when you get down to it, a bit of ego stroking in the end. But I'd been writing newspaper columns for about a dozen years, ever since I was finishing up college and straight on into working for newspapers after that. And in both Mississippi and then throughout the West Coast, I just had scribbled out columns. probably 300 or 400 of them over the course of those years, and it formed an interesting just kind of timeline of your life, you know, as you go on and writing about whatever struck your mind that day, really. And I looked at them, and I was relatively pleased with what I'd done with myself, and I thought, it's a shame these are all in newspapers that got burned up in somebody's chimney or, you know, recycled in their mulch, and that it'd be nice to have something a little more permanent. And a friend of mine had used Lulu to self-publish, because I really wasn't interested in trying to go out and say, finding a publisher and, oh, please publish my book, and isn't it wonderful? And it was more of a, you know, rather than trying to make $1 million, just basically having that tangible keepsake of what I had worked on over the 10 years in journalism, and just kind of culled the best of them out, so to speak, and put them together. And for my son also, I thought, oh, it'd be nice to, when he's old enough to really care about it, which will probably be a good long time, say, you know, this is what Dad's life was like, you know, in the crazy world of the 1990s and early 2000s. And so Lulu was very good to just publish it. Yeah, you basically send it to them and they publish it, and you don't have to pay, you know, $200 or whatever it is to get an X number of copies. You can just print as many as you want. And what I did is I made several for family members and gave a handful out to friends, and other friends just ordered it online, and it's out there, but it's not something I had to invest a huge amount of, you know, time and money in to put together.
And so that's worked out for you then?
Yeah, it's been good. It's still there, and I occasionally will, you know, just go there and order a copy and send it to a friend of mine, or maybe a blogger that I particularly admire, I might mail them a copy of it, and it's
so
it's
nice. Lulu will actually print out a paper copy and ship it too, won't they?
Yeah.
Because so I bought mine obviously electronically.
Yeah, you can do it, buy it by a PDF, or you can also just order a hard copy, and it's the equivalent of, you know, buying a paperback book. It's like $12 or something like that. So it's one of those nice little creations of the digital marketplace that would not have been imaginable, you know, 15 years ago. It's still a form of vanity self-publishing, but it's a little more polished and less of an investment than it would have been before.
Yeah, well, it's obviously less costly than traditional vanity publishing. My grandfather actually cashed in his life insurance to publish his wife's memoirs. She's my step-grandmother.
Yeah, I didn't want to do something like that to publish my little scribblings, you know. It was just a thought that I'd like to have it more than just a clippings file somewhere.
Well, fair enough, too, because it makes them survive.
Yeah.
But having been a newspaper columnist and a blogger, would you say that they're similar in any way?
Oh, yeah. My blog is a lot more freeform. And it's funny, actually, my newspaper column production really dropped off around the time I started my blog, so it's definitely not a way to keep writing newspaper columns. I had also kind of written myself crazy over almost a decade, and I'd done a lot more entertainment writing and movie reviews that took up more and more of my time, that I focused more on that in newspapers and did the blog as a way to just kind of have a bit more free form. And I've been doing it for almost 4 years now, which is...
That's quite a long... In blog years, that's forever.
Yeah, the last year has been a little tougher, where a couple times I've thought, why am I still doing this? Because the audience kind of is finite after a while, I find, for myself. I'd like to get it to a point where it bumps up a little more, but you know, it's in the end, it's a hobby, so it's...
Fair enough. So is my podcast.
Yeah. You got to, if it's keeping you awake at night, where you're thinking, oh, how can I make this, you know, really take off? And why am I doing it?
Yeah. It becomes sort of pointless.
Yeah.
And you just completed 30 days of blogging, 30 blogs in 30 days or whatever it was. I've forgotten what you call
it. Yeah, 30 days of bloggery. That was my test in January. My wife actually suggested that I should...
should punish her for that.
Well, I'd really trickled off, especially what with buying a house and moving in the end of last year. I'd trickled off to maybe writing a couple times a month, and I thought, all right, you know, am I going to do this, or am I going to get off and just, you know, do it half-heartedly, or am I going to do it? And I thought, well, January, I'm just going to write every single day. And it was a little tough, but I had enough come up in January, like the big day out and things like that, that provided several days of material. But I'm definitely not an everyday blogger. But if I can get back to writing, you know, 3 or 4 times a week, I'm pretty comfortable with that now. But it did reaffirm for me that it's something I enjoy doing, and, you know, we'll keep doing until I really lose interest in it, or just find, oh, yeah, somebody will pay me for it.
Whichever comes first. Yeah. You might want to explain, if you will, where the name Spatula Forum comes from.
That's a long question, and I'm not sure I have an answer for it. It really was just picking words out of the air. I had a column... This was back in 1994, 1995, for a little alternative newspaper called Oxford Town in Oxford, Mississippi, which was where I basically got my start really in my career. I eventually was editor of that publication for about a year and a half there, and I'd written a column for it because the editor at the time had said, oh, you can write a column, anybody can write a column. He was very free-spirited, and you know, anybody in the town that could write would write a column, and it might last one or two installments, but I was given the free rein to write a column and just continued writing like crazy, but I didn't have a name for it. I had a couple of names. I don't recall them all now. At one point, I called it Mashed Potato Sandwiches. It was after a childhood treat that I liked to eat, but I just had too many people ask me what that was, and I said, all right, I'm not going to call it that, and I think I just decided, well, I'll call it something for them, and I like the sound of the word spatula. I just always thought it had a nice ring to it, and in the end, I was like, well, it has a pleasing sound. It rolls off the tongue, and I just adopted it and ended up calling the column that, and then throughout the newspapers that it ran in ever since, I would call it that when they let me call it that. Some newspaper editor said, no, you're just going to call it by your name. We're not going to call it spatula form. But when I started the blog, it just seemed like, oh, that's the natural title. Now I'm stuck with it.
Yeah, unfortunately, for better or worse.
But anybody on the internet that's ever looking for interesting information about spatulas gets drawn to my blog and really vastly disappointed because I don't have much to offer.
Maybe we should just have more pictures of spatulas or something. The spatula of the month or something.
Yeah.
Well, your book, of course, is called Spatula Form, and it's available through lulu.com. There's a link on your blog. And your blog is called spatulaform.blogspot.com, and it's about music, movies, books, and living in New Zealand, etc.
Pretty much it. You know, I'll just write whenever it comes to mind. And maybe if I were a little more focused, I'd have more of a daily audience and just write about one thing or another, but it's nice to just write whatever comes to mind that day. Mm.
Yeah, well, do check out Nick's blog. And Nick, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today, and I hope to have you back again sometime.
Thanks for having me.
I'd just like to again thank Nick for joining me on today's podcast. He is actually the second blogger that I've met in real life, and the other one was Don from Don and Darren. And yes, I know that Don and Darren are two people, and not just one, as I said at the beginning of the discussion, but I just got a little confused. It happens to me sometimes, that CRS thing kicking in, I think. But before I stop for today, I did want to go over comments because I don't want to let them pile up. And first up, I have an audio comment from Anthony from Ashanti No Lemon.
Hey, Arthur, this is Anthony from Ashanti No Lemon. I'm actually going through and trying to listen to as many podcasts as possible to get caught up, and I got caught up on your little political discussion you guys had. I just wanted to say the only thing I'm concerned about is if we do get like a McCain and Huckabee versus Hillary and Obama or something, I'm worried about a very close election and then again stolen again with our inadequate voting system. So hopefully that won't be the case. But anyhow, just wanted to say enjoy the show and keep up the good work, and I will be talking to you guys soon on the game day. Bye.
Thanks for that, Anthony. I actually share a lot of your reservations. I'll actually talk about that a bit in a second when I go over the written comment as well. But I personally don't think we should be writing off Huckabee just yet. He may be a force in one way or another. We'll just have to wait and see, I suppose. But I do share your concerns. And Anthony's podcast is from Columbus, Ohio, if you haven't listened to it. Actually, I don't think there's a link on my show notes. I should put one in on my blog, I mean. I just realized that. Sorry, Anthony, I'll put one on. Maybe not right away, but soon. but Anthony often takes part in Archer's group shows, which is what he's referring to at the end. We refer to it as the gangbang. But unfortunately, it's usually when I'm not available because I can only record one a month. Nevertheless, Anthony's very interesting, and do check out his podcast, Ashanti No Lemon. There's actually a link on Archer's site if you're really keen before I can get one on mine. But the written comment was from David, that Blue Jeans guy, who said, I still think that Mike Huckabee has too much political visibility to be just written off. His overt religiosity is giving fundamentalist and literalist Christians the voice they feel that has been missing from politics in many years. He speaks for the segment who feel that the only way America can ever be great again is if the wall between church and state is torn down. They are the ones who lament that public schools do not have mandatory prayer and religious assemblies. To give a personal example of this, my schools had religious assemblies all the way through my senior year in 1988, and for many years beyond. They are the ones who feel that a woman must bow to her husband's will. They are the ones who feel that morality can be legislated, despite the fact that a little thing called prohibition proved that wrong. They are the ones who could see who would see Roe v. Wade and Scopes overturned. They are the ones who feel that preserving the environment is putting a false god in front of the one true god, in quotes. They are the ones who actually believe that God descended into the voting machines in Florida and Ohio, modified the votes, and ensured a Republican victory in 2000 and 2004, because it was his will that a Republican be in the White House. They are the ones who have been manipulated into believing that welfare is sinful, even though multiple biblical passages support the idea. These are the people who believe that Huckabee speaks for them. Huckabee may be a Republican, may be the Republican Party's best hope of not having a mass defection of fundamentalists and literalists from the Republican Party in favor of a third-party candidate. In fact, it's conceivable he could become a third-party candidate if he's not chosen by McCain as his running mate, assuming McCain does get the nomination. Again, don't treat Huckabee like he has no chance. We may be in for a surprise if we do. And in response, I said, I share your suspicion of him, and while events in recent days have changed things somewhat, I think he still remains a threat. But better that Republicans fight with themselves and foster divisions within their party, because it'll make them easier to beat. Maybe. Now, as I just said in response to Anthony's phone comment, I do have reservations about this whole situation, and I'm a bit uneasy about Huckabee and about Huckabee still being in the race, because he, in my view, essentially wants to set up a Taliban-like state, only with a Christianist agenda, because he talks about amending the Constitution to bend to his version of God's will and all that sort of thing. However, I mean, it remains to be seen. He may or may not be a force when, in the fullness of time, we'll have to see. And there is also the cynical view, which is that the main reason he's staying in the race is to give attention to the race, because if he were out, McCain would be just waltzing to the finish line, and the media wouldn't be paying any attention whatsoever to him. They'd only be talking about Barack and Hillary. And so long as he's in the race, the media will pay attention to the race, and they'll keep talking about the Republicans. Now, I don't know if that's true. I mean, that's what the cynics say. The cynics say it's all about keeping the Republican campaign in the news so that people don't forget about it by the time the conventions roll around. Certainly, it is indisputably true that if Huckabee were out of the race, that the media wouldn't be paying any attention to McCain whatsoever, because, I mean, there'd be no news. So you can see why the cynics would suggest that there's more of a secret agenda going on here. But I couldn't possibly say one way or the other whether or not that's true, obviously. But for what it's worth. Now, on Friday's episode, I'm going to be doing something a little bit different. Today, the Prime Minister of Australia, Kevin Rudd, formally apologized to the stolen generations in Australia. And this was something that the previous Conservative Prime Minister, John Howard, said could never be done, flatly refused to do for over 10 years. So I'm going to be talking a bit about that and about the whole concept of reconciliation and what that can mean. So we'll see how that turns out. I'm trying to put together a few things beforehand. And we'll see if I can pull it off. But I do have some audio clips that I'm going to be including in that episode. And I'm also going to be talking a bit about iTunes. Now, I know I said I wasn't going to talk about it anymore, but if you remember, I said unless I had something to say about it, and I do. So I'll be having a few words about that, but not about five-star reviews, although you're welcome to leave one if you want. I'm up to 21 now, by the way. but that's not what it's about. Something different. But that's on Friday's episode, and that is it for today's episode. Do leave me a comment on my blog, amrins.com. You can send an email to me personally at Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrins.com, and if you do that, I won't read it on the podcast. Or you can send a comment to comment, singular, comment, at amrins.com, and that I will read on the air, on the podcast, on the air. Jeez. And like Anthony did, you can ring my U.S. listener line at 206-339-8413. But that is it for this episode of the Amrins Podcast, and I'll be back again on Friday. Thanks for listening. Bye.